everyone to the next episode on the South African Sport and Exercise Medicine Association podcast. Today, we continue to delve into the world of large gathering and event medicine, and we are honored and privileged to have Dr. Darren Green with us today to give us some insights. Darren is a sports and exercise medicine physician, operating as an event medicine specialist, heading up the corporate events department for MediClinic SA. He functions as the chief medical officer for many international sporting events, including the Rugby Sevens World Cup, British Irish Lions Tour, Cape Town Cycle Tour, APSA Cape Epic, Sunshine Tour, which is a PGA-affiliated golfing tournament, and the Cape Town Marathon. Hi, Darren. Thank you for being here, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Okay, let's jump right into it. So in your own words, Darren, what is it that you do?
Well, I stay married to one person. I also am a father and dad to two. And to sustain that lifestyle and role, I work a day job just like everyone else, amongst other things, and work in the field of sports and emergency medicine.
Okay, lovely. And what got you into the event medicine specifically?
100%. So in the role as event chief medical officer for MediClinic Southern Africa, I started off by actually working as either an emergency physician or a sports physician at various sporting events that MediClinic used to be involved with and host in terms of the medical sport over the many years. And in that experience, I got to see and experience some of the unique offerings in medicine in remote sites. So whether we were doing cycling or running, triathlons, et cetera, all the different components involved with patient care and player welfare and so forth, all were new experience for me at that stage. And I just wanted more and more of it. That on the background of doing quite a bit of expedition medicine for almost 8 years, going to remote sites of the world with the Department of Environmental Affairs and the South African National Antarctic Program as an expedition doctor to Antarctica, Tristan da Cunha, Gough Island. So the niche expertise and exercise across sporting codes in remote locations is the thing that got me interested specifically in eventing medicine.
Fascinating. Your career has been a couple of years in the making, it seems. So for the layman, how would you describe the term event or large gathering medicine? This is specifically to people who are coming across the term for the first time. How would you describe it to someone?
Great. So I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think event medicine is about providing medical support at an event. So there are different scales of events in terms of the support required. And a lot of people don't actually know what those requirements are just offhand. And they have no idea what goes into the background in terms of planning for these kind of events. But it would depend on the sporting code, for example. So looking at the different kinds of events that you have, a large gathering or any mass participation event is more than 1,500 people. But I look after events where you've got 30 to 35,000 people taking part, for example, like marathons or cycle tour, etc. So one in that experience, one must then understand that there are different components and levels of contingency planning and risk mitigation when you're dealing with a spectrum of participants. In other words, your amateurs, your weekend warriors, those that have lost a bet at a braai on a weekend, who have now been dared to take part in a sports event without the adequate preparation, ranging from that level of athlete participating all the way through to your elite athlete, which is a world champion or a highly competitive, regular, fit athlete. So in itself, then you must look at the different risk factors involved for that full population that you have to look after. When it comes to large gatherings and event medicine, most people think of the participants only, but my role in event medicine is not only looking after the participants in the sporting code or activity, it's also looking after the spectators, also looking after the crew that are working on the event. Even the cameramen that are part of the broadcasting team form part of your vigilance, observation and prep in terms of setting up what happens if anything goes wrong with any of those people in the team. So that forms part of the preparation and planning.
Okay. And in your experience, I was just thinking about what you said, is it usually the crowd or the competitors or the athletes that need your services?
So that would depend on the event. Sometimes as the event chief medical officer, you've got to look at the entire offering and ask the right questions in terms of health and safety for any event. As an event chief medical officer, one is often placed in the role where you have to find out who are you partnering with? What is their experience like? Have they ever done this before? Do they actually know the full scope and capacity of what is required for, let's say, an international rugby game for 60,000 people? And what level of experience do they have in dealing with emergencies at that level? So one has to do the due diligence in firstly assessing your partners with which you choose to work. Secondly, then the medical staff that you get involved with, how do you choose them? What criteria are you using? How are you governing and auditing the standards of their qualifications, the updating of their qualifications, and the appropriate expertise required for the specific sporting code that you're going to be supporting?
I'm really glad that you brought up this term of the chief medical officer. Tell me, in general, what is expected of a chief medical officer at an event?
Yeah, it sounds like such a... like a Red Indian chief kind of title, doesn't it? And for me, it's the cold shiver down your spine, which says, when it comes to medical, the buck stops with you. So you are the person responsible for looking at the full scope, the full planning, preparation, layout, and execution of an emergency medical plan, as well as the medical operational plan for an event. So the event chief medical officer is the person that is in charge of implementing and executing the medical operation plan successfully. So event medical officer then needs to know what that plan is, has to be involved in designing that plan with all the relevant stakeholders and appropriately qualified staff in the pre-event stage first, before you even get to during event. And then there are other things that we will also be involved with post-event. So the role as CMO involves, obviously, as I said, total overview of the project with all its risk and planning beforehand, your execution on day and game day, and then how you wrap up that process afterwards as well.
Okay. And do you have a lot of contact with the team constituents? So I assume there's a large medical team that's there on the day. Is the chief medical officer responsible for running the team during the day as well?
Correct. So you're with your prep and planning, looking at the specific requirements for an event. Let's say it's a World Cup tournament, for example, like the Under-20 World Rugby Championship being held in South Africa. The first thing you need to know is what is the expectation of the client? What are they looking for? They might come to you and say, we're looking for someone to provide the pitch side medical care for the event. The event chief medical officer would say, okay, who's looking after the training sessions? What's happening to the players when they warm up? Where are they warming up? Oh, they're warming up on a different field across the road from the stadium. What medical plans do you have in place there? Where are they staying? Oh, they're living in a hotel. Oh, so what happens while the traveling teams are living in South Africa in a hotel? Who do they call when something goes horribly wrong, like an allergic reaction in one of your players at breakfast time who's had nuts, for example, in his muesli by accident? So one has to be available and also vigilant of identifying all the touch points that affect an event. So as chief medical officer, you need to be able to look at it from a distance and say, have those boxes been ticked in terms of the full spectrum of care? And you asked me why I decided to get involved with event medicine. One of the big reasons is curiosity of coming up with new innovative ways of dealing with challenges that we find in healthcare with sport and different activities, but also wanting to get out of the office to treat patients. In other words, working in remote conditions, in different environments where you have to adapt and come up with innovative solutions to challenges. That's a major part of the job in this specific industry.
Everything inside and outside of the box.
Correct. And the inside stuff, I mean, if you think about a big event as a chief medical officer, firstly, you need to understand the legacy and the history behind an event. So you need to look at where's the event coming from? What is the perception in terms of the community? What's the impact been on the community of that event? How does it make use of the resources and how many resources in a specific area, city, town, suburb, etc.? Then you need to look at the calendar and ask yourself, but is it concomitant with other events happening at the same time? Are there two or three big events happening at the same time, which places your referral networks at risk for timeous intervention and appropriate referral? Things like which hospitals are on standby. If you're having the Cape Town Cycle Tour or the Cape Town Marathon in Cape Town, and you've got a Stormers rugby game up at the stadium, for example, what is your emergency plan? How do they overlap in terms of the different events occurring at the same time? And then you've got a Rocking the Daisies concert, for example, also all happening at the same time. Are the resources sufficient? Has everyone been briefed ahead of time? Is everyone on standby, aware of the load and prepped? Because you are totally dependent on your infrastructure and referral systems and support structures to actually present a successful event. So what event medicine actually entails at this level in your pre-planning stage involves looking at all those components, looking at the manpower and staffing skills, looking at the infrastructure and hardcore resources, looking also then at the affiliated services and team members that you work with in the pre-planning stages. A simple example will be working with SAPs in terms of safety on the streets, working with traffic in terms of access and egress of ambulances, golf carts. How do they access the treatment facility? How do they get out in the middle of a gridlock city to get a heart attack patient to the hospital? So you're dependent on traffic, you're dependent on fire, you're dependent on SAPS, for example, police services, even weather when mitigating risk for things like environmental conditions, when we consider hot weather, cold weather, contingency planning, water and ice plans, etc. So there's so much to consider, and you're dependent on those relationships with all these teams, like disaster medicine, for example. If there's a bomb threat or terrorism or boycotting that happens during a mass event, what is your plan? You've got a sick patient. People are injured during that event. How do you treat them? How long can you treat them? How can you refer them out? How do you get them out? How do you get them to more definitive care as needed? So you can see that the extent of this operation is certainly a lot bigger than meets the eye initially and what you see on your TV screen.
It is indeed eye-opening. It's very easy to get preoccupied with the day of the event or the week of the event, the part of it that's shown on TV, as you say. But for these big events, considering all the components you've now mentioned and the elements of preparation and so on, how long usually do you have to prepare beforehand? How long beforehand do you start preparing?
Good question. So some events you start at least 6 months in advance because there are certain components that I normally would ask for meetings with event organizers to see what's changing on their radar. Maybe they're introducing a new component to an event. Maybe they're changing the format of an event. Let's say, for example, the Cape Town Sevens rugby, for example, format changed into splitting it up into two fields, one in the stadium, one outside the stadium last year, for example. That means two separate medical teams, a referral structure to a central hospital, radiology on site. How do we get the patients to radiology? How do we synchronize that? And then also meeting the expectation of the client, you know, with two different venues, there's additional cost involved, for example. So managing all those expectations, but making sure that the pathways are in place beforehand. So that is one component. And then one also certainly needs to look at how you prepare everyone for these changes. So arranging an operational planning meeting with the event is something that happens months in advance. And depending on the type of event, I've got to, for example, start looking at niche expertise, qualifying people that need to be my match day doctors or, let's say, concussion HIA specialists for a Rugby World Cup championship. They need to meet certain criteria when we select and choose those people. And I'm responsible for checking those credentials, making sure that they've got the depth and credibility to actually function in that specific role. So matching the right qualified person with the right role is important. And it's not just about their clinical skills and delivering on the day. It's about their admin ability, their ability to communicate their knowledge on the field, off the field, and post-event in terms of documentation at the highest level, so that it satisfies, obviously, the criteria for all the high-level, high-performance stakeholders involved. We expect a certain standard. So that means, obviously, identifying these people early, booking them out on their calendars, and then briefing them properly about what's expected from them. And with that then comes, obviously, more regular check-ins as you get closer to the event, making sure they know what they're going to have at their disposal, what tools they have, what kind of support structures they will have when working on an event. That's now speaking to all the staffing component: nurses, doctors, paramedics, people working with logistics, video review analysis, for example, when it comes to concussion assessments, etc. So yeah, there's a lot of thought that goes into those processes. And then obviously one then plans ahead in terms of what do you want in the briefing of the teams that are coming and all the participants. And when it comes to 2-3 months out, one is already thinking of what about the safety of my amateur athletes? Let's say we're doing a running event. What can I do as the chief medical officer to ensure that my athletes are best prepared on race day, even the amateurs? A lot of public education programs. What messaging do I want to get across? Where are the risks in terms of an unconditioned athlete running a 10K race? Because we see the high incidence of serious medical encounters, as has been described and reported on, in the shorter distance events, not the ultras and the marathons, but the 10 and 21Ks are where you often have drop attacks with cardiac arrest in people that haven't prepared adequately, that aren't conditioned, and that haven't had seeding events to qualify them for an event. So that is why the educational component starts months in advance of trying to get people aware of what they can do to empower themselves and prohibit, obviously, adverse medical events. A simple thing like, please don't take anti-inflammatories when doing endurance events to protect your kidneys, for example, from kidney failure, which can then have an effect on your thermoregulation and affect your heat stroke risk. Yeah. So little things like that in terms of public education, athlete education, play a major role from a chief medical officer perspective.
Darren, I believe I saw an interview with you recently. I think it was the 22 Cape Town Marathon, where there was an amateur athlete who, I think, he did not prepare adequately. And during the day, he actually developed a heat injury and collapsed at the finish line. I don't know if you remember
this. I recall that case. Yeah, that's a heat-related illness. A patient that developed heat stroke while doing the marathon and collapsed actually about probably 200 meters from the finish line. So it was right at the end of a 42-kilometer running event.
Had he prepared adequately?
Yeah, in terms of mileage, yes. In terms of training schedule program, you know, in terms of the fit principles of exercise prescription, you would have fitted the criteria, put in the work. But there were some gaps in terms of understanding some of the finer details on race day, like how do you manage environmental conditions? What can you do? Those are practical tips like wearing sunscreen, planning your water and ice breaks, what kind of hydration and nutrition are you taking in? And then with that, what is your pre-race condition on the morning of your race? Have you done your checks to see that you don't have any red flags before starting the race, like a pre-existing viral illness, like diarrheal illness of the gut, etc., that could have a major impact in a marathon? And in this case, specifically, also having a bit of muscular pain, back pain, anti-inflammatories, and the risk that anti-inflammatories can play in so many aspects in different systems on race day. So, yeah, certainly one or two things that I think if he goes back could have managed better. But in general, he actually worked quite hard to prepare for this event.
Nice. And we touched on it briefly close to the beginning. We were talking about referral systems.
Yes.
Have you ever had a case where your event was quite remote and your appropriate referral site was quite a ways off? And how did you deal with it? Like, for instance, I can imagine the Cape Epic. At some point, the cyclist is quite far into the mountains.
Correct. Yeah, that goes quite remote. You're right. So if you think about what we do and what we specialize in, we put together teams with niche expertise that provide medical support to events that go into remote sites. So if you're in the middle of the Witzenberg Mountains and Tulbach, so, you know, Sarensburg, where we were, you've got to look at where are your closest definitive care centers. Where's your closest cath lab if someone needs to go to cath lab for a cardiac event, for example? If you're in need of stroke care, where do you go? So you need to have done all that research beforehand, firstly. Secondly, you need to have an emergency action plan. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do in these phases. And what most people don't know is we actually set up a fully functional hospital peripherally wherever we work. So that is part of my job as the event chief medical officer, designing a medical facility with my team that comprises normal treatment beds for soft tissue injuries, emergency medicine, general medical problems, but also an ICU component that deals with a very high escalated level of care in terms of needing to stabilize acutely ill patients in an ICU setting. So in that area, we would have, for example, the capabilities of dealing with cardiac emergencies all the way through to heat stroke, cold water immersion, hypothermia, kidney failure, seizures, and even ventilating patients, stabilizing them before we either fly them off to another ICU of the hospital receiving or to a nearby hospital. And that is obviously quite a large responsibility in setting that up. So it's not only an equipment thing, it's a training and skills thing. So when we select our teams and when we check our team's clinical capabilities, also the ability of the teams to work under those conditions in a remote setting where you can't just call the specialist who will come down in 10 minutes to give you a second opinion. You need to be able to function at that level with that kind of pressure and also know where your limitations are and how to move patients on quickly that need to be either flown out or transported to the closest definitive center. So, yeah, that does mean that when it comes to referral centers, I look at the geographic location. I look at all the surrounding resources. I look at what resources I'll be requiring, whether it's spinal, head injury, orthopedics, general medicine, nephrology for dialysis in the case of the Absacape Epic. And then I prime and get specialist teams on standby long ahead of time. I go and meet with them. I discuss the needs, the requirements. I discuss the need to open wards and to create capacity, surge capacity. Because if we have a day when the weather is 45 degrees with a humidity of 60, I know we're going to be working a 16-hour day and we're going to see 300 patients in a day, for example, on an event like that. So you need to do the contingency planning and you need to have those referral networks primed and ready before the event starts. You can't go and try and set them up during the event.
That brings a lot of insight into the role, or at least your role as a chief medical officer.
Yeah, those are some of the main points. The points that I haven't mentioned under the chief medical officer role is obviously the high-level meetings with all the stakeholders beforehand, understanding the full mandate of what we're having, as it affects a province quite significantly, and all the different components that you have to consider when you plan. That aside, with my own team, I've got to make sure that they are up to scratch with the latest development trends in their fields and also that they've done the due diligence and plan, which is why the key roles that I've got are logistics and clinical logistics as well as risk and disaster medicine. So very important to work with them and also to know what your timelines are in terms of these events and really plugging into their expertise.
All right. I wanted to ask you a little bit about people who, or at least medical officers who are not the chief medical officer.
Sure.
And what their roles are on the day. Do they always stay in the medical tent or the peripheral hospital, if you will, in these events? Or is there a role for a medical officer outside of that setting?
100%. So let's differentiate quickly. The role of the event chief medical officer on the day would depend on the event involved. Let's take the cycle tour, for example, with 30,000 cyclists. Myself, as the chief medical officer, who's been involved with setting up the entire deployment with my team, setting up the hospitals, the facilities, etc., where we have 15 medical points along the route, where we have a race hospital with dedicated ICU facilities, etc., and a massive amount of pre-hospital EMS, emergency medical service staff. If you take that component, we do all that planning and setup. And on the event day, as the chief medical officer, I'm not even on the ground at the event. I've got to be out of that in what we call the JOC or VOC, which is the operations center, the hub that controls all the resources on the day. And there's a reason why we can't be in the heart of the action, because if there is a bomb threat, if there is a disaster, then there's a certain requirement for us as the heads of our different fields to be outside of the chaos, to actually control the chaos, move resources around, give direction and instruction in view of the threat or whatever it might be in the case of an event. So for certain events, I'm in the operation center. For others, I'm actually in the medical tent on the ground where I'm working. So it depends on the different events in terms of where the need is the greatest and the magnitude of the event. The other medical officers, as you rightfully asked, what are their roles? Well, they will be designated roles according to their experience and appropriate exposure so that they don't feel overwhelmed with what they have to deal with on event day. So I would choose medical officers in emergency medicine, for example, that could be immediate care leads on a rugby field when there is a resus or when there's a surgical airway required. If someone's got blunt trauma to the larynx or to the neck and we're concerned specifically about laryngeal spasm, etc., and you need an advanced airway fitted, you want people that are trained and experienced in that. So I need to make sure that my team can cover the full range of pathologies required in terms of skill set and in terms of, and to do that confidently. And that means assessing what they do in their day-to-day clinical practices and working with them to actually see where they are in that process. And then confidently, I can step away and let them actually function in that role. So that's part of the job. Other medical officer roles on an event like the Cape Epic, a mountain biking event, for example, the different components in the tent in the morning in the race hospital, you'll have people involved with soft tissue injuries and preparation, a bit of a knowledge of things like strapping and preventative care, understanding bike setup and the mechanics, giving advice to them from a sports medicine perspective before the event, before they start that day, and looking after them. Also reviewing people with internal medicine knowledge in terms of renal function, understanding kidney failure in endurance sport, because kidney failure in sport and kidney failure just occurring in a diabetic has totally different nuances in understanding how to approach the management of these patients and what the causative etiologies were, obviously. So that plays a role. So the medical officers, as I say, are then matched according to their skill sets, exposure, experience, and also what their passions are.
All right. I think you mentioned earlier a bit about emergency plans that you need to have in place and protocols that the whole team follow.
Ah, yes.
In the case of an emergency or a big injury that needs immediate intervention, how long typically does it take you to prepare your team with these protocols and ensure that they are correctly set up and prepared for it?
So in terms of understanding protocols, when you have doctors, nurses working in the team regularly, they can see how do we handle, for example, a heat stroke patient. Those that are new to the team, we try to give them some exposure first, coming in as volunteers to witness what we do in that setting, giving them exposure to the tempo at which things need to happen in terms of decision making and planning your equipment, and also then using the equipment appropriately, making decision-making, but the full spectrum of care in terms of even referring the patient out to the next level of definitive care. So, yeah, it takes a while with people that are new to go through some of the literature and some of the packs we send you in preparing for events. Things like, for example, what are the causes of collapse in an endurance athlete? Looking at the interesting things of exercise-associated hypertension, looking at cramping differently, because all cramps are not created equal. Understanding things like cramping, for example, in someone that's not an endurance athlete and someone in an event are two different things. The causes of cramping and understanding that cramping plus a high temperature, cramping plus diarrhea, or cramping plus dark urine might indicate rhabdomyolysis, and that's a life-threatening event or a condition. So we need to action that. So to get those finer nuances in, it's about supplying them with information, reading up beforehand, attending seminars or webinars, and then also sharing knowledge with them, giving them exposure in terms of eventing medicine and working with our team. And then me, I spend a lot of time actually getting to know my staff as to what they really enjoy and where their fears are. One of the big things I've learned over many years is that doctors really struggle to share their vulnerabilities. They think it's a sign of weakness to show where they feel insecure or weak regarding knowledge. And it's one of the biggest loopholes in medicine, because you can't be an expert in everything all the time. Trends change, knowledge changes, evidence base changes, and you can't keep up to date with absolutely everything at the same time. But as a team of physicians, nurses, medics, you can all bring something to the party as you find something new, developing a new trend, a new management plan or suggestion. We rely on those huddles to actually really share and also challenge the status quo with improvements often. And after every event and during events, we have those kind of forums where I allow people to bring something that they'd like to bring to the table for the knowledge of everyone in the group to facilitate growth and development, which is very important. And I think knowing your limits as a practitioner and also as a medical officer is one of the greatest skills of leadership that I admire, because you need to know when this is, you know, you a little bit rusty or a bit old in that field, but the team will back you up because there's always someone in our teams that has got some experience. And that's how I choose and handpick people that work in a bouquet of a team, for example. So there'll be someone that's really good with soft tissue injuries or someone that's really good with trauma. And so there you have this almost a diffusion osmosis of knowledge happening all the time as people are trying to learn from each other. And that makes event medicine really wonderful, the way that I run my teams.
All right. And Darren, could you maybe mention some of the different sporting codes that you've been involved with,
okay,
and what the different components are for each of them that you need to consider compared to each other, of course, what the differences are in preparing for them?
Sure. So a mass participation event, like 30,000 athletes, for example, let's say something like the cycle tour, that's big. Mm. So your public education, I've mentioned, your medical screening ahead of time to identify people who are at risk, send them notifications or just a word of caution that, listen, you might be a vascular path based on a screening questionnaire you filled in, for example, and then suggest to them, obviously, that they have that checked out so they're cleared. Advice to those people long ahead of time regarding things like training with flu for myocarditis, looking at all the below-the-neck signs in terms of influenza, looking for glands, fever, body pain, so the normal stuff that the public don't necessarily know. So getting that information out in a way that is friendly, that's not threatening, and that's accessible, and sometimes just creative and a relaxed fashion and not a preaching fashion, yeah, can be quite far-reaching in terms of helping the profile of your race day final, you know, the final group of people that take part on race day. By all means, just as we caution people with risk factors not to take part, so too we tell people that are taking part, these are the red flags you need to look for during an event or while you're participating and so forth. But so all that falls under public education, your athlete
sure.
education. But other than that, if you take the different sporting codes, which is what you were asking about, if you take rugby, for example, I want to know whether the medical teams, let's say a physio and doctor that are traveling with a team, I want to know that they're ISO trained and qualified. I want to know, in other words, whether we're speaking the same language. When I say ISO, what do I mean? Immediate care in rugby or advanced immediate care in rugby. Have they all completed the clinical training, the physical training in terms of the practical skills? Have they been declared competent by a World Federation body in terms of a certain standard in pitch side care or not? Have they done the modules? If they're nurses that are working on my event, I need to know, have they done the modules on match day protocols? Do they understand that the blood injury is 12 minutes, they need to get a player back on the field? Do their HIAs work in terms of oxygen, et cetera, provisions, et cetera, et cetera? So do they also know a little bit about anti-doping? Are they aware of which drugs they shouldn't be giving in the hospital or the clinic? Not giving your captain of the All Black team, for example, sinus medication for his sinuses without understanding the implication of a TUE. So those kind of things are quite important across the different sporting codes. So if you look at rugby, you want to know qualifications, preparation, and so forth as well. If you look at something like mountain biking, I've got lots of international athletes that are coming to do those events. For them, they're seeing their physicians, cardiologists, and they're training 15 to 20 hours a week in that niche, very high performance area of the most grueling mountain biking event in the world. So with those athletes, I have communication from 3 months before the event already for queries as the race doctor. I'm introduced to them by the event organizer. And what I can do then is obviously answer their questions, make sure that they've got everything in place. I've had heart transplant patients doing the Cape Epic. I've had players with artificial limbs and prosthesis doing the Epic, etc. And you can work with them ahead of time as the chief medical officer. But the different sporting codes, certainly, the nuances that you have to be aware of within the code. So to put it simply, not all sporting codes have beautiful guideline documents on medical care and medical care provision.
No, exactly.
And some of them are outdated, firstly. But, in terms of deciding what are the minimum requirements within the different sporting codes, some of those federations, like triathlons, will have a guideline from an international body. Let's say Cycling SA has a guideline as to what their expectations are. The mountain biking, internationally, you'll think of things like the UCI, for example. With SA Rugby, what are SA Rugby's protocols regarding minimum requirements for schoolboy rugby, for club rugby, for provincial rugby on a weekend? When is the HIA protocol indicated, not indicated, and so forth? When do you follow what we call the recognize and remove protocol for under-19s, etc.? So those basic questions all form such a big part of the different sporting codes. So you have to familiarize yourself with each code, each federation, and understand the minimum requirements. But in my role as chief medical officer, often I don't look at the minimum requirements. I have to look at the requirements that I would be happy with in terms of risk mitigation and covering all my bases. So that's an important differentiation to make.
Okay. And for these different sporting codes, could you maybe mention some regulatory bodies that you need to adhere to? Or do you have
good
in South Africa?
So I think firstly, one starts off with events in South Africa. One has to be aware of the acts. So there are documents and acts and policies that govern you being compliant. So I'll give you a simple one. If it comes to the medical staff, we all know you need to be registered with the HPCSA.
Sure.
Paramedics need to be registered. Nurses need to be registered with SANC, the Nurses Council. Your registration needs to be current. It needs to be updated. You need to fulfill certain criteria. You're not losing your CPD accreditation over time, for example. And so those things have to happen, obviously, on their own. Then you have the policies that govern sports and recreational events or acts. And that's important. You need to familiarize yourself with understanding when it comes to health and safety, what are all the things one needs to consider and be aware of that are obligatory in providing a service. And for that, it's interesting. There's the SASRIA Act, for example, has different components. And one of the components is the SAMS risk matrix, which is a document that you have lots of plug-in questions about the size of the event, the amount of spectators, where it is, etc. And also that then gives you a risk stratification as to whether it's a low, medium, or high-risk event, which gives you a clearer indication of what the minimum requirements are for deployments of how many doctors do you need, how many BLS medics do you need, ILS, ALS medics, etc. But those are minimum requirements. And that is based on spectator numbers in terms of risk profile. That is not based on the participant and the sporting code specifically. So that's what a lot of people don't know. So those documents as policies and acts refer to the size of the event from a spectator component. For us in sports and exercise medicine, we look a lot at the details involved with the specific sporting code, the associated risks of what type of pathologies we're going to see and injuries, the proximity to areas of specialized care and referral networks in terms of planning our deployment, our amounts of staff, our response times, and our ability to respond quickly and transfer quickly if needed. So you understand the components there are different, looking at the government or the policies rather, the acts in terms of referring to the size of the event with spectators, but the finer detail that we are involved with is planning around the specific codes and risk mitigation around those features.
Fascinating. So tell me, Darren, have you ever had an event where the finances or the resources provided to you to prepare for the event adequately were sufficient or weren't sufficient, rather? And how did you deal with that in that case, where you couldn't meet the minimum requirements with what was provided for you?
It's a great question. Well, currently in my role as event chief medical officer at MediClinic, we simply wouldn't do the event. So I'm not in a position where I go to an event if I'm not happy with the resources being adequate, if I'm not happy with the referral structures, if I'm not happy that there aren't trauma beds available for a C-spine transfer for an international Springbok game, for example. Those were some of the challenges I had to face at the height of the third wave during COVID up in Gauteng with the British and Irish Lions tour. All the pressure of kickoff happening comes down to the event. Also, one of the biggest pressures as the event chief medical officer is if the medical services are not ready to support the level of care that is required for a match of that caliber, the match can't start. Mm. So we've got to speak up. We've got to be bold. We sometimes, if there are no ambulances on site at the start of a match, let's say your ambulance is late, you cannot start unless your resources are all on site and in place. And that often means making loads of people angry and often means major cost implications for broadcast rights. But the bottom line is accountability and risk mitigation rights. If something happens in that time period and there's negligence or medico-legal implication, you can imagine that you had the ability, obviously, to speak up and you didn't. Mm. So that's also part of it. And that applies to schoolboy rugby games, for example, as well, to all our staff, medics that are working next to the field. It's your full right, for example, to raise the alarm and say, guys, if someone injures their neck right now, I don't even have a basic spinal board and a harness to immobilize a patient. This is a high risk. It's a minimum requirement by the implication of the Box Spot program and so forth at school level, and you can speak up. So, yeah, you need to be aware about what your rights are and also about what the expectations are from a legal perspective in terms of managing the equipment, infrastructure, not everything being in place when you arrive, which is not always easy.
No, for sure not easy. Mm-hmm. You need to know yourself, and I guess you need to have a certain amount of bravery as well, standing up to the people who are demanding things. In any case, so we've spoken about the different sporting codes. Let's maybe take a different turn. Are there implications in preparing for events that are catered towards different genders? Let's say an all-female event or an all-male event or even a mixed event. Are there different things that come into consideration, or is it all pretty much standard? You prepare the same way?
No, you make an interesting question. We do see in certain sporting codes that when you're traveling, for example, as a team doctor, there certainly are things you need to be aware of. When you're the team doctor of a female rugby team, there's certain pathologies that you might have to consider and certain medical conditions that are more prevalent, for example. And you need to prepare for that in terms of your medication, your kit that you're traveling with, what you've got available in terms of drugs. If you're treating, for example, UTIs or a fungal infection, do you have the right medication? Etc. and so forth. There's certain things that are more prone in females than are in males from a medical perspective. In terms of injury profile, it's quite interesting to also go and look at mass participation events. And when we look at the shorter distances, we found for major cardiac events, obviously, that females had a slightly higher risk in terms of cardiac events and eventing as well, specifically in the shorter route distances, like the 21K Two Oceans, for example. Some great work in that area, done by Corin Schwaber, Professor Martin Schwalness, and the SAFER studies. So some interesting reading for those of you interested in looking at risk factor profiles for males, females, gender, etc. And then we also had a lot of work being done looking at some cycling events. It's almost like, who's the better driver, males or females? And cycling risk for traumatic injuries, etc. A lot of work being done there, some interesting research coming through that I'm sure you're all going to be very interested in. So yeah, definitely something's worth noting. When it comes to rugby specifically, not so much the gender involved or the male or female game, but definitely a lot at the level of expertise that they play. At elite level, you must imagine if women's rugby in South Africa has only been around for, let's say, 8 years, compared to other countries where it's been around for 20 years, the speed at which they develop through the ranks in terms of professional sport, in ladies' sport, in a contact sport, also in the different countries, depending on resources, support, and so on, is a different level. So your ability to monitor injury surveillance in terms of how you fall, positioning of the head, body position going into contact, etc., all those things have been extensively researched. And SA Rugby, I know, with World Rugby, has a load of studies that look specifically at the level of experience from amateur through to pro level, and comparing the different games and risk factor profiles in males and females.
Fascinating. Surely there's going to be a lot of research and reading to be done in future. Tell me, Darren, I want you to take us through a day in your life as the Chief Medical Officer. Let's pick an event you recently did and just take us through your experience of it, what you had to do, just so we've got an on-the-ground type of idea of what it is like to be in your shoes.
Yeah, you're often first on site and last to leave. Let's start there. So I see a lot of darkness in my life. And I'm part of, luckily, some of the light that happens. But what I do get to see are the real smiles, the enthusiasm when someone says, oh, my word, I did it. When they do get to manage something that they've never managed in a normal EC or casualty unit out in the field and in a peripheral site.
Sure, sure.
So I'll give you a quick example. Let's take a big event like Cape Town Marathon, for example, where my day starts with a massive briefing of the full medical team in the race hospital. Obviously, the people that are at the medical points along the route, they get briefed separately. So I have briefings with them in the run-up to the event, separate briefings, and just what I expect from them, what resources they have, what the referral system comm structure would be, and so forth. But for Marathon, I then have a massive briefing in the morning where we cover everything from the legacy of the event, the pathology we expect to see on race day, understanding the protocols in the tent. The flow of the tent is very important in your hospital, the triage system, the sort and sift as they come in, how you direct those to physio, who's coming to us, which patients sit where, how the floor plan of the hospital is run to ensure that we move patients quickly. Just remember, this is not like an admission ward at the event, at the end of the event. This is a stabilize and transfer because you've got 30,000 people coming. You can't let someone park off for a drip there and lay there for 4 hours to say, we'll see how it goes and maybe we can send you for a drip later on. So our responsibility is to get to the nitty-gritty serious patients very quickly, manage them and get them appropriate care if they need to be in terms of referral. Those that are not as serious to sort and sift them quickly so they can decant the tent and move out and go on to their celebrations with their medals on the public areas and get home and out of the precinct as soon as possible. So the morning starts with that, but it includes briefings on patient keeping notes, record keeping, accurate diagnosis coding, because we need to provide afterwards things that are post-event, the other things that I do as a chief medical officer, which include the reports, post-event reporting, and those stats, presentation, and details to the event organizer or to the events inspectorate from the Department of Health. So those are useful things. But accuracy of their notes, diagnose coding, so forth, the platforms you'll be recording on, we have to go through all that. Understanding, obviously, the full responsibility of the day. We designate things. I would be involved with the resus teams. First resus, who's the team? The level of detail that we dig down to are things like who's going to do airway, breathing, circulation, who's going to put up drips, AEDs, which is your first team in resus, which is the second team, if two resuses come in, etc. And just as we do that in preparation for the day before we're off and the gun goes off for that first kilometer, for rugby, I do exactly the same. I'm on ground as the chief medical officer ahead of time with my match day doctors, my concussion doctors, with my field side medic team and my in-treatment site hospital treatment team. I have a huddle with them before the match. I generally am on site meeting with all of them about 90 minutes before kickoff, where I have to run extensive drills in detail of every possible scenario, including things like the referee dropping with a heart attack, for example, with a coronary event, or off the ball collapse during warm-up with someone getting a bee sting and having anaphylaxis. The resus teams are identified pre-event. The equipment is checked pre-event. The equipment is located in places where everyone knows if I have a double header on the field, in other words, two athletes colliding on a rugby field, and I need two teams to respond, firstly, who responds to which team? Secondly, where's the equipment that they need if I need two spinal boards and the two players down? That we're not scurrying, running around. If there's CPR required and a cardiac arrest at any time on the field in a major spectator sport, have we prepared adequately for shields around the scene when we do CPR? So the golf cart preparation, the drugs, the emergency drugs, the equipment needs to be checked. A person, a tall person like Ibn Ezebeth with his long legs, for example, does he fit on the spinal board? Can the spider harness that you're strapping him down with to immobilize him go over the chest of, let's say, your biggest prop on the field? Then we need extra length harnesses to come over the chest of the pec area. And all those modifications happen because of the needs of practicing and in advance beforehand and then realizing all these little niggles and improvements we need to make. So, yeah, the practice, the drills have to happen beforehand. We do radio comms checks. The allocation, for example, of who's the left side of the field, right side, the call signs on the radio, the comms through cement buildings and through the stadium stairs. Are your radio comms working when you do test them through areas like that, for example, for cell phone signals down as on WhatsApp when you're in a stadium filled with 70,000 people and so forth. And then we still have to manage other components in my briefings before matches like rugby of things like social media policy. What about the privacy of the patient? What about you taking inappropriate filming instead of watching the game, doing your job? So those kind of things we brief in terms of responsible medical governance with the drills beforehand. So my day will start off like that, and then I'll be involved during the match, obviously making sure at a high level that my match day doctors are doing what they need to do in terms of paperwork, in terms of how they present themselves to the tournament directors. Their communication strategies need to be clear. They need to be accurate. I need to be happy with that, because if they're not, I've got to intervene as the event chief medical officer. I also deal with liaison queries between team managers, etc., and the union and the tournament director. I sit in on those planning feedback meetings, and I'm involved at ensuring that every single piece of the puzzle is in accordance with that level of excellence. So with international events such as the Cape Town Sevens, for example, it's a great honor to put on a medical offering that was voted the best medical offering in the world for the tournament. That is a great honor in terms of the medical team. With minor tweaks and improvements every year, working with the medical director of SA Rugby, or Clint Reedhead, and his team, and World Rugby's John Langley. So what an absolutely amazing opportunity that is.
Congratulations, it's quite an achievement.
Yeah. Well, when you work with all the different experts in their field, like Doug Langley from World Rugby, what an honor, because he takes so much pride in what he does. And so do, as I mentioned, SA Rugby and the guys on the ground as well. But every team member, from the medics that are next to the field working on the golf cart, all the way through to the nurses, all the way through to the doctors, everyone is made to feel that their contribution is a major contribution to the success of the product at the end of the day.
What you have said has been really eye-opening as to all the work that goes on in the shadows while the rest of us are focusing what's going on the field. Tommy Doan, what are some of the unique challenges that are faced by medical teams in South Africa specifically?
I think in our field of providing medical support to sporting events, I think one of the big challenges are funding, where people that do what we do in terms of niche expertise at this level of specialized care at sporting events used to be viewed as a luxury in the past. now we're seeing that from event organizers, a lot of them have also woken up and realized that it's no longer a luxury. It's a necessity to partner with people that are really thorough in the field of event medicine. In other words, that know what's expected, that know what to put in place, that know what the risks involved are, and to do the adequate planning to ensure the best possible outcome. And it's an ever-growing field where you need to constantly look at your medical operational plan. How can I improve it? How can I better it? How can I move it to the next level? And that, in our country, is a major challenge in the sense that people want that level of care, but they don't always have the funding available to do that exactly. So that means you need to teach people and expertise, and that's a major component that we need to keep looking at. So, yeah, as I've mentioned, I think a lot of people need to work on that, plan ahead of time, and partner with people that are really dedicated to the safety of our athletes.
Mm-hmm. And has something like load shedding, for instance, has it ever influenced what's going on at your events?
Yeah, it certainly can. It does. But in the pre-planning, if you haven't thought about that, then, you know, you shouldn't be in eventing medicine if you can't ask what's the power supply backup plan. We should be looking at all those contingencies, water and so forth. One of the greatest things is also the discord between emergency medical services. So you might have a medical provider looking at, for example, the injured people on any event, rugby, athletics meetings, whatever. But what's the coordination like between the ambulance service and the emergency services that have to be called upon to come and help you transport patients out to the appropriate facility? What are their capabilities? What's their timeline? What's the size of your event? What if you've got three patients waiting and they all semi-serious? What do you do? So you need to have those backup systems, resources, all those numbers in place. And then the other one's the big one that you asked about, the other challenges, unique challenges, the referral systems. A lot of our events happen on weekends and after hours.
Yeah.
Where can you find a specialist to help you? So are they available? But if you plan in advance and you put together teams that are really well-informed beforehand, you can plan. Then you're not bothering someone on their school holidays with their family, for example, where you haven't thought about needing a spinal surgeon for your event. So putting those referral networks together in advance so people can plan their holidays, the doctors and specialists, they want to be a help. They want to be there, but you can't ask them in the week before the school holidays if they've booked a holiday with their family, would you mind staying around as a neurosurgeon to help me for a schoolboy rugby tournament?
Can imagine how that goes.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got to show due diligence in that. So that's a major challenge. I think a lot of events just think medics and medical staff are just waiting for referrals. But the problem is with niche expertise and specializations in sports medicine, those people might not be available on a weekend. If you want a specific shoulder specialist, for example, and you've got international standard of care, let's say the All Blacks are playing the Springboks, and I need a dedicated knee specialist and a soft tissue radiologist that specializes in soft tissue that can provide a report that is acceptable and exceeds expectations on an international stage, for example, that's what we want. We want to do South Africa proud in terms of events we put on here. And that means exceeding the expectations, getting the best of the best that we have when we support our athletes. And that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Are there any considerations for international athletes coming to our local events? Do you need to prepare for them in a certain way?
Good question, because you would think, but they all have the same health problems as us. Yes, they do. But what they don't have is medical insurance in South Africa. So one of the things we don't think about is, what if the hospital you take an international athlete to, how do they treat the athlete in advance if they can't get authorization to admit this patient for an open tibia fibia fracture, for example? Those things need to be discussed before the event, not after the event. So a simple example will be at the Absa Cape Epic, for example, those athletes will travel, they have health insurance. Communicated by the event organizer that they suggest that they are covered by health insurance while they're in South Africa. A lot of them will travel with a credit card, pay their emergency center bill if they need an x-ray or what have you. And then they will ask for documentation But that I arrange beforehand and speak to the hospitals and the specialists saying, these international athletes will be paying, let's say, for their services, but they need to claim back from their health insurance when they go back home. So, yeah, just funding health insurance, one component of the problem. Language barrier. Have you ever thought about how do you speak if you don't speak Spanish? And the guy's talking to you, asking him about hydration and his plan and whether he's taken any energy gels along the route, any caffeine gels, for example, giving him arrhythmias. How do you communicate with the patient? Google translates. So we come up with amazing apps and ways of bridging that divide and gap. And we ask the partner to come to the medical tent, et cetera, as well. So when it comes to working with international athletes, I think what's really important is giving them the assurance that we have the resources, we have the expertise here, but we need to communicate that well to our clients. And when the different sporting codes, that's mountain biking, for example, they need to know what the emergency plan is. So if you want to communicate that with your rider comms ahead of time or with the team managers meetings, briefings for rugby, we do a lot of work with SA Rugby, for example, in having a manager's briefing and a medical briefing where detail goes into if this happens at the practice during a training session, this is the process that needs to be followed. Step one, call this number. Step two, call the team liaison officer. Step three, chief medical officer, who is myself, will be informed. Step four, referral to appropriate facility will be decided on, etc. So some wonderful networks that get set up in that way. But I think attention to detail and briefing prior is what leads to success.
Yeah, of course. And Darren, tell me, while doing your time in the field, what are the advancements that you've seen that you felt were the biggest advancements?
Sure. I think I was asked to give a talk quite recently on the use of technology in the medical field and inspire young upcoming medical professionals that are still busy studying medicine, physiotherapy, bio, etc. At one of our universities. And one of the things I think I zoomed in on was concussion and head injuries, the evaluation of identifying concussion and managing concussion, the evolution over three decades of that specific entity and topic is something that really gets me excited. If you go and look at someone needing to be totally knocked out to be removed from the field of play, to where if they had initially lost tone and had loss of consciousness, came around, woke up, they would just stand them up, shake it off, and send them back onto the pitch. How life has changed over the past three decades in terms of identifying concussion, firstly. Secondly, how to confirm diagnosis. And only in 2012 did we obviously trial in South Africa and Cape Town, obviously historically significant with the first execution of the pitch side assessment for concussion in assessing a risk or higher risk for confirming concussion with the Junior World Cup that we had here. And what an incredible experience it was to be part of that as the first year in Cape Town in rolling out that concussion tool for HIA, head injury assessment. That still didn't solve the problem completely because you're still at the mercy of interpretation of clinical symptoms, but also the cognitive assessment, balance assessment, et cetera, in the pitch side score. With evolution even further, we get to a point where we as evidence-based physicians are in search of an objective tool, not a subjective tool, in determining concussion and the force on the brain. And the latest developments of the gum guards, obviously, with electronic chips that measure angular acceleration, deceleration, the G-force, etc., chip that's involved with the gum guards. How exciting, once again, for Cape Town and us to be part of that initial rollout by World Rugby. Once again, last year, WXV tournament in Stellenbosch. So proud of South Africa and the role we play in being part of pioneering fields and rolling out some of the greatest research that's going out in the world in terms of endurance events, in terms of rugby. And our field of sports and exercise medicine is just absolutely loaded with passionate people who want advances in terms of excellence, technology, coming up with new innovative solutions. So that was just the one component. The other one in my field in eventing medicine that I find really useful is some really great work done by grandfathers or experts in the field. We're privileged to be surrounded by experts in field medicine who are pioneers in South Africa, ranging from Tim Noakes and his work on hypertriemia and athletes and hydration, all the way through to Martin Schwellness, Wayne Derman, Jeroen Swart. They've all contributed at the world stage to groundbreaking work. And one of them are their reporting of medical encounters. We didn't have a standardized format of how we could share experiences and what kind of medical conditions we were seeing on any event, specifically big events. If you think about like cycling events, community races, etc.
Are you talking about sharing it internationally?
Yes, I'm speaking about speaking or categorizing medical injuries and illnesses in a way that we can all compare events so that the research can become quite accurate. And we can also compare events across the globe as to why are they having more muscle cramping? Why are we having dehydrations in that event, that time of the year, seasonal links, etc. So the work done by the crowd in terms of the consensus statements on medical encounter reporting, I feel that was a great advancement, great breakthrough in terms of categorizing what is the definition of a mild, moderate, or serious medical encounter with the classification. Are they minor, moderate, or significant? And then classifying them, the suggested outline of these problems, injuries according to anatomical site for medical illnesses, classification according to systemic involvement, for example, and then the different conditions we see in sports medicine that are must reports compared to going too big and not having the essentials reported. So, yeah, with the IAAF and World Athletics, we were able to obviously narrow down forms and identify, for example, templates as to how we report on medical encounters during things like marathons, for example. So once again, very proud of some of our colleagues here that have been involved with that kind of breakthrough. And also, I'm still interested in many more advancements in this field.
It's incredibly refreshing to hear that South Africa is at the forefront in research for this field. It's definitely something to be proud about. Darren, what are some of the areas that you feel need improving in event medicine in South Africa?
I think the relationship between event organizers and us in the field of sports medicine and exercise medicine can be improved. What I mean by that is getting event organizers and their motives for having events, sometimes it's legacy, sometimes it's maintaining a 60-year-old event, other times it's starting a new event, sometimes it's financial motivation to have a big event so you can make money, have loads of participants, whatever their motivation is. But to combine our forces in looking at the effect of exercise on medicine and on the human body, I think partnering more and more in terms of ethically and transparently looking at questions that we would like answered, that we don't know about yet. I mean, I think of all the research post-COVID that we would like to have conducted, looking at things like vaccination and sport, looking at COVID and sport. I mean, there's work on long COVID and how we relate that information to help better plan going forward. So I think making the event organizers aware of some of the typical challenges we have in the field that we'd like answers to, like when to train with a respiratory infection, for example, when not to train, and looking at those risk factor modifications, getting them on board to support some of the research, for example. So I think that's a big field going forward, and I think a lot of us work really hard at that, but not everyone has the same buy-in, and one needs to work through those things. And other than that, I'm very excited about the way forward, I must say.
That's good. John, could you maybe share an experience with us, something that's meant a lot to you during your career, something that you remember fondly and have built from, motivated you to continue?
Yeah, I think for me, as an event chief medical officer, you tend to feel very lonely when you've got to come up with a plan and design the plan. So I think surrounding yourself with a team that you trust, with people that have the same passion and they understand that the motive of why you're doing what you do definitely isn't worth a title. It's more about making sure you have all the bases covered. It is a very high responsibility role that comes with a lot of stress. A lot of the decisions you make affect big amounts of people and sometimes even life-death decisions. So I think surrounding yourself with people that get the mandate, that agree with the mandate and love what they do, choosing those confidants is important. For me, the amazing part is identifying people that I really admire as experts, subject matter experts in their field. And when I have a specific dilemma or challenge or some problem that I'm wrestling with, I can pick up the phone and speak to a lot of our colleagues in sports and exercise medicine for the specific appropriate field. And it's meant a lot to me in this role of mine to be able to do that. And colleagues that will always make time, and they will phone me the day after an event, for example, saying, I heard you had a cardiac arrest or a death of a patient at that event. How are you holding up? And no one ever thinks about, you know, how much you actually take on that emotional load. So that's a big component of responsibility for me. And having colleagues, I think, within our fraternity that really support me and reach out means a hell of a lot, because all of us want the best for the patient and the athletes, whether it's to rehab them, whether it's to get them fit to lose weight, or whether it's just to get them healthy again. And that's what I think makes this specialization of sports and exercise medicine very special in South Africa.
Thank you for sharing that. Darren, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure to host you. And we are looking forward to seeing where you go, and we are watching you and looking forward to the next time you're going to be on the podcast, of course.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it. And absolutely great having all the MPhil and MSc students that are doing sports and exercise medicine all reaching out to try and get involved with event medicine, and really excited about the future. So thanks for the opportunity.